The Amway distributors appear to be bewildered, happily so, but nonetheless bewildered, by the startling power of the bug. Of course, by now, you and I should not be. The reciprocity rule governs many situations of a purely interpersonal nature where neither money nor commercial exchange is at issue. Perhaps my favorite illustration of the enormous force available from the reciprocation weapon of influence comes from such a situation. The European scientist Ibel Ibisfeld provides the account of a German soldier during World War I whose job was to capture enemy soldiers for interrogation. Because of the nature of the trench warfare at that time, it was extremely difficult for armies to cross the no-man's land between opposing front lines. But it was not so difficult for a single soldier to crawl across and slip into an enemy trench position. The armies of the Great War had experts who regularly did so to capture an enemy soldier, who would then be brought back for questioning. The German expert of our account had often successfully completed such missions in the past and was sent on another. Once again, he skillfully negotiated the area between fronts and surprised a lone enemy soldier in his trench. The unsuspecting soldier, who had been eating at the time, was easily disarmed. The frightened captive, with only a piece of bread in his hand, then performed what may have been the most important act of his life. He gave his enemy some of the bread. So affected was the German by this gift that he could not complete his mission. He turned from his benefactor and recrossed the no-man's land, empty-handed, to face the wrath of his superiors. An equally compelling point regarding the power of reciprocity comes from an account of a woman who saved her life not by giving a gift, as did the captured soldier, but by refusing a gift and the powerful obligations that went with it. The woman, Diane Louis, was an inhabitant of Jonestown, Guyana, in November of 1978, when its leader, Jim Jones, called for the mass suicide of all residents, most of whom compliantly drank and died from a vat of poison-laced Kool-Aid. Diane Louis, however, rejected Jones' command and made her way out of Jonestown and into the jungle. She attributes her willingness to do so to her earlier refusal to accept special favors from him when she was in need. She turned down his offer of special food while she was ill because I knew once he gave me those privileges, he'd have me. I didn't want to owe him nothing. The rule enforces uninvited debts. Earlier, we suggested that the power of the reciprocity rule is such that by first doing us a favor, strange, disliked, or unwelcome others can enhance the chance that we will comply with one of their requests. However, there is another aspect of the rule besides its power that allows this phenomenon to occur. Another person can trigger a feeling of indebtedness by doing us an uninvited favor. Recall that the rule only states that we should provide to others the kind of actions they have provided us. It does not require us to have asked for what we have received in order to feel obligated to repay. For instance, the Disabled American Veterans Organization reports that its simple mail appeal for donations produces a response rate of about 18%. But when the mailing also includes an unsolicited gift, gummed individualized address labels, the success rate nearly doubles to 35%. This is not to say that we might not feel a stronger sense of obligation to return a favor we have requested, only that such a request is not necessary to produce our indebtedness. If we reflect for a moment about the social purpose of the reciprocity rule, we can see why this should be so. The rule was established to promote the development of reciprocal relationships between individuals so that one person could initiate such a relationship without the fear of loss. If the rule is to serve that purpose, then an uninvited first favor must have the ability to create an obligation. Recall also that reciprocal relationships confer an extraordinary advantage upon cultures that foster them and that, consequently, there will be strong pressures to ensure that the rule does serve its purpose. Little wonder, then, that the influential French anthropologist Marcel Mauss, in describing the social pressures surrounding the gift-giving process in human culture, can state, "There is an obligation to give, an obligation to receive, and an obligation to repay." Although the obligation to repay constitutes the essence of the reciprocity rule, it is the obligation to receive that makes the rule so easy to exploit. The obligation to receive reduces our ability to choose whom we wish to be indebted to, and puts that power in the hands of others. Let's re-examine a pair of earlier examples to get a sense of how the process works. First, let's return to the Regan study, where we find that the favor causing subjects to double the number of raffle tickets purchased from Joe was not one they had requested. Joe had voluntarily left the room and returned with one Coke for himself and one for the subject. There was not a single subject who refused the Coke. It is easy to see why it would have been awkward to turn down Joe's favor. Joe had already spent his money. A soft drink was an appropriate favor in the situation, especially since Joe had one himself. It would have been considered impolite to reject Joe's thoughtful action. Nevertheless, receipt of that Coke produced an indebtedness that manifested itself clearly when Joe announced his desire to sell some raffle tickets. Notice the important asymmetry here. All the genuinely free choices were Joe's. He chose the form of the initial favor, and he chose the form of the return favor. Of course, one could say that the subject had the choice of saying no to both of Joe's offers. But those would have been tough choices. To have said no at either point would have required the subject to go against the natural cultural forces favoring reciprocation arrangements that Jiu-Jitsu Joe had aligned himself with. The extent to which even an unwanted favor, once received, can produce indebtedness is aptly illustrated in the soliciting technique of the Hare Krishna Society. During systematic observation of the airport soliciting strategy of the Krishnas, I have recorded a variety of responses from target persons. One of the most regular occurs as follows. An airport visitor, a businessman, let's say, is hurriedly walking along through a densely peopled area. The Krishna solicitor steps in front of him and hands him a flower. The man, reacting with surprise, takes it. Almost immediately, he tries to give it back, saying that he does not want the flower. The Krishna member responds that it is a gift from the Krishna Society and that it is the man's to keep. However, a donation to further the society's good works would be appreciated. Again, the target protests. I don't want this flower. Here, take it. And again, the solicitor refuses. It's our gift to you, sir. There is visible conflict on the businessman's face. Should he keep the flower and walk away without giving anything in return? Or should he yield to the pressure of the deeply ingrained reciprocity rule and provide a contribution? By now, the conflict has spread from his face to his posture. He leans away from his benefactor, seemingly about to break free, only to be drawn back again by the pull of the rule. Once more, his body tilts away, but it's no use. He cannot disengage. With a nod of resignation, he fishes in his pocket and comes up with a dollar or two that is graciously accepted. Now, he can walk away freely, and he does, gift in hand, until he encounters a waste container where he throws the flower. Purely by accident, I happen to witness a scene that demonstrates that the Krishnas know very well how frequently their gifts are unwanted by the people who receive them. While spending a day observing a soliciting Krishna group at Chicago's O'Hare International Airport a few years ago, I noticed that one of the group members would frequently leave the central area and return with more flowers to resupply her companions. As it happened, I decided to take a break just as she was leaving on one of her supply missions. Having nowhere to go, I followed. Her journey turned out to be a garbage route. She went from trash can to trash can, beyond the immediate area, to retrieve all the flowers that had been discarded by Krishna targets. She then returned with the cache of recovered flowers, some that had been recycled who knows how many times, and distributed them to be profitably cycled through the reciprocation process once more. The thing that really impressed me about all this was that most of the discarded flowers had brought donations from the people who had cast them away. The nature of the reciprocity rule is such that a gift so unwanted that it was jettisoned at the first opportunity had nonetheless been effective and exploitable. The ability of uninvited gifts to produce feelings of obligation is recognized by a variety of organizations besides the Krishnas. How many times have each of us received small gifts through the mail? Personalized address labels, greeting cards, key rings, from charity agencies that ask for funds in an accompanying note. I have received 5 in just the past year, 2 from disabled veterans groups, and the others from missionary schools or hospitals. In each case, there was a common thread in the accompanying message. The goods that were enclosed were to be considered a gift from the organization, and any money I wished to send should not be regarded as payment, but rather as a return offering. As the letter from one of the missionary programs stated, the packet of greeting cards I had been sent was not to be directly paid for, but was designed to encourage your kindness. If we look past the obvious tax advantage, we can see a reason why it would be beneficial for the organization to have the cards viewed as a gift instead of merchandise. There is a strong cultural pressure to reciprocate a gift, even an unwanted one. But there is no such pressure to purchase an unwanted commercial product. The rule can trigger unfair exchanges. There is yet one other feature of the reciprocity rule that allows it to be exploited for profit. Paradoxically, the rule developed to promote equal exchanges between partners, yet it can be used to bring about decidedly unequal results. The rule demands that one sort of action be reciprocated with a similar sort of action. A favor is to be met with another favor. It is not to be met with neglect, and certainly not with attack. But within the similar action boundaries, considerable flexibility is allowed. A small initial favor can produce a sense of obligation to agree to a substantially larger return favor. Since, as we have already seen, the rule allows one person to choose the nature of the indebting first favor and the nature of the debt-canceling return favor, we could easily be manipulated into an unfair exchange by those who might wish to exploit the rule. Once again, we can turn to the Regan experiment for evidence. Remember in that study that Joe gave one group of subjects a bottle of Coca-Cola as an initiating gift and later asked all subjects to buy some of his raffle tickets at 25 cents apiece. What I have so far neglected to mention is that the study was done in the late 1960s when the price of a Coke was a dime. The average subject, who had been given a 10-cent drink, bought 2 of Joe's raffle tickets, although some bought as many as 7. Even if we look just at the average subject, though, we can tell that Joe made quite a deal. A 500% return on investment is respectable indeed. But in Joe's case, even a 500% return amounted to only 50 cents. Can the reciprocity rule produce meaningfully large differences in the sizes of the exchanged favors? Under the right circumstances, it certainly can. Take, for instance, the account of a student of mine concerning a day she remembers ruefully. About 1 year ago, I couldn't start my car. As I was sitting there, a guy in the parking lot came over and eventually jump-started the car. I said thanks, and he said you're welcome, as he was leaving. I said that if he ever needed a favor, to stop by. About a month later, the guy knocked on my door and asked to borrow my car for 2 hours, as his was in the shop. I felt somewhat obligated but uncertain, since the car was pretty new and he looked very young. Later I found out that he was underage and had no insurance. Anyway, I lent him the car. He totaled it. How could it happen that an intelligent young woman would agree to turn over her new car to a virtual stranger, and a youngster at that, because he had done her a small favor a month earlier? Or more generally, why should it be that small first favors often stimulate larger return favors? One important reason concerns the clearly unpleasant character of the feeling of indebtedness. Most of us find it highly disagreeable to be in a state of obligation. It weighs heavily on us and demands to be removed. It is not difficult to trace the source of this feeling, because reciprocal arrangements are so vital in human social systems, we have been conditioned to be uncomfortable when beholden. If we were to ignore breezily the need to return another's initial favor, we would stop one reciprocal sequence dead and would make it less likely that our benefactor would do such favors in the future. Neither event is in the best interests of society. Consequently, we are trained from childhood to chafe emotionally under the saddle of obligation. For this reason alone, then, we may be willing to agree to perform a larger favor than we received, merely to relieve ourselves of the psychological burden of debt. But there is another reason as well. A person who violates the reciprocity rule by accepting without attempting to return the good acts of others is actively disliked by the social group. The exception, of course, is when the person is prevented from repayment by reasons of circumstance or ability. For the most part, however, there is a genuine distaste for individuals who fail to conform to the dictates of the reciprocity rule. Moocher and welcher are unsavory labels to be scrupulously shunned. So undesirable are they that we will sometimes agree to an unequal exchange in order to dodge them. In combination, the reality of internal discomfort and the possibility of external shame can produce a heavy psychological cost. When seen in the light of this cost, it is not so puzzling that we will often give back more than we have received in the name of reciprocity. Neither is it so odd that, as was shown in an experiment conducted at the University of Pittsburgh, people will often avoid asking for a needed favor if they will not be in a position to repay it. The psychological cost may simply outweigh the material loss. The risk of still other kinds of losses may also persuade people to decline certain gifts and benefits. Women frequently comment on the uncomfortable sense of obligation they can feel to return the favors of a man who has given them an expensive present or paid for a costly evening out. Even something as small as the price of a drink can produce a feeling of debt. A student in one of my classes expressed it quite plainly in a paper she wrote. After learning the hard way, I no longer let a guy I meet in a club buy my drinks because I don't want either of us to feel that I am obligated sexually. Research suggests that there is a basis for her concern. If, instead of paying for them herself, a woman allows a man to buy her drinks, she is immediately judged, by both men and women, as more sexually available to him. Reciprocal concessions. There is a second way to employ the reciprocity rule to get someone to comply with a request. It is more subtle than the direct route of providing that person with a favor and then asking for one in return. Yet in some ways, it is more devastatingly effective than the straightforward approach. A personal experience I had a few years ago gave me firsthand evidence of just how well this compliance technique works. I was walking down the street when I was approached by an 11 or 12-year-old boy. He introduced himself and said that he was selling tickets to the annual Boy Scout Circus to be held on the upcoming Saturday night. He asked if I wished to buy any at $5 apiece. Since one of the last places I wanted to spend Saturday evening was with the Boy Scouts, I declined. "Well," he said, "if you don't want to buy any tickets, how about buying some of our big chocolate bars? They're only a dollar each." I bought a couple and, right away, realized that something noteworthy had happened. I knew that to be the case because, A, I do not like chocolate bars, B, I do like dollars, C, I was standing there with two of his chocolate bars, and D, he was walking away with two of my dollars. To try to understand precisely what had happened, I went to my office and called a meeting of my research assistants. In discussing the situation, we began to see how the reciprocity rule was implicated in my compliance with the request to buy the candy bars. The general rule says that a person who acts in a certain way toward us is entitled to a similar return action. We have already seen that one consequence of the rule is an obligation to repay favors we have received. Another consequence of the rule, however, is an obligation to make a concession to someone who has made a concession to us. As my research group thought about it, we realized that was exactly the position the Boy Scout had put me in. His request that I purchase some $1 chocolate bars had been put in the form of a concession on his part. It was presented as a retreat from his request that I buy some $5 tickets. If I were to live up to the dictates of the reciprocation rule, there had to be a concession on my part. As we have seen, there was such a concession. I changed from non-compliant to compliant when he changed from a larger to a smaller request, even though I was not really interested in either of the things he offered. It was a classic example of how a weapon of automatic influence can infuse a compliance request with its power. I had been moved to buy something not because of any favorable feelings toward the item, but because the purchase request had been presented in a way that drew force from the reciprocity rule. It had not mattered that I do not like chocolate bars. The Boy Scout had made a concession to me. Click and whir, I responded with a concession of my own. Of course, the tendency to reciprocate a concession is not so strong that it will invariably work in all instances on all people. None of the weapons of influence considered in this book is that strong. However, in my exchange with the Boy Scout, the tendency had been sufficiently potent to leave me in mystified possession of a pair of unwanted and overpriced candy bars. Why should I feel a strain to reciprocate a concession? The answer rests once again in the benefit of such a tendency to the society. It is in the interests of any human group to have its members working together toward the achievement of common goals. However, in many social interactions, the participants begin with requirements and demands that are unacceptable to one another. Thus, the society must arrange to have these initial incompatible desires set aside for the sake of socially beneficial cooperation. This is accomplished through procedures that promote compromise. Mutual concession is one important such procedure. The reciprocation rule brings about mutual concession in two ways. The first is obvious. It pressures the recipient of an already made concession to respond in kind. The second, while not so obvious, is pivotally important. Just as in the case of favors, gifts, or aid, the obligation to reciprocate a concession encourages the creation of socially desirable arrangements by ensuring that anyone seeking to start such an arrangement will not be exploited. After all, if there were no social obligation to reciprocate a concession, who would want to make the first sacrifice? To do so would be to risk giving up something and getting nothing back. However, with the rule in effect, we can feel safe making the first sacrifice to our partner, who is obligated to offer a return sacrifice. Because the rule for reciprocation governs the compromise process, it is possible to use an initial concession as part of a highly effective compliance technique. The technique is a simple one that we can call the rejection-then-retreat technique. Suppose you want me to agree to a certain request. One way to increase your chances would be first to make a larger request of me, one that I will most likely turn down. Then after I have refused, you would make the smaller request that you were really interested in all along. Provided that you have structured your requests skillfully, I should view your second request as a concession to me and should feel inclined to respond with a concession of my own, the only one I would have immediately open to me, compliance with your second request. Was that how the Boy Scout got me to buy his candy bars? Was his retreat from the $5 request to the $1 request an artificial one that was intentionally designed to sell candy bars? As one who has still refused to discard even his first Scout merit badge, I genuinely hope not. But whether or not the large request, then smaller request sequence was planned, its effect was the same. It worked. And because it works, the rejection-then-retreat technique can and will be used purposely by certain people to get their way. First, let's examine how this tactic can be used as a reliable compliance device. Later, we will see how it is already being used. Finally, we can turn to a pair of little-known features of the technique that make it one of the most pervasively influential compliance tactics available. Remember that after my encounter with a Boy Scout, I called my research assistants together to try to understand what had happened to me, and, as it turned out, to eat the evidence. Actually, we did more than that. We designed an experiment to test the effectiveness of the procedure of moving to a desired request after a larger preliminary request had been refused. We had two primary purposes in conducting the experiment. First, we wanted to see whether this procedure worked on people besides myself. That is, it certainly seemed that the tactic had been effective when tried on me earlier in the day, but then I have a history of falling for compliance tricks of all sorts. So the question remained, does the rejection-then-retreat technique work on enough people to make it a useful procedure for gaining compliance? If so, it would definitely be something to be aware of in the future. Our second reason for doing the study was to determine how powerful a compliance device the technique was. Could it bring about compliance with a genuinely sizable request? In other words, did the smaller request to which the requester retreated have to be a small request? If our thinking about what caused the technique to be effective was correct, the second request did not actually have to be small. It only had to be smaller than the initial one. It was our suspicion that the critical thing about a requester's retreat from a larger to a smaller favor was its appearance as a concession. So, the second request could be an objectively large one, as long as it was smaller than the first request, and the technique would still work. After a bit of thought, we decided to try the technique on a request that we felt few people would agree to perform. Posing as representatives of the County Youth Counseling Program, we approached college students walking on campus and asked if they would be willing to chaperone a group of juvenile delinquents on a day trip to the zoo. The idea of being responsible for a group of juvenile delinquents of unspecified age for hours in a public place without pay was hardly an inviting one for these students. As we expected, the great majority, 83%, refused. Yet we obtained very different results from a similar sample of college students who were asked the very same question with one difference. Before we invited them to serve as unpaid chaperones on the zoo trip, we asked them for an even larger favor, to spend 2 hours per week as a counselor to a juvenile delinquent for a minimum of 2 years. It was only after they refused this extreme request, as all did, that we made the smaller zoo trip request. By presenting the zoo trip as a retreat from our initial request, our success rate increased dramatically. 3 times as many of the students approached in this manner volunteered to serve as zoo chaperones. Be assured that any strategy able to triple the percentage of compliance with a substantial request from 17% to 50% in our experiment will be frequently employed in a variety of natural settings. Labor negotiators, for instance, often use the tactic of beginning with extreme demands that they do not actually expect to win, but from which they can retreat in a series of seeming concessions designed to draw real concessions from the opposing side. It would appear then that the larger the initial request, the more effective the procedure, since there would be more room available for illusory concessions. This is true only up to a point, however. Research conducted at Bar-Ilan University in Israel on the rejection-then-retreat technique shows that if the first set of demands is so extreme as to be seen as unreasonable, the tactic backfires. In such cases, the party who has made the extreme first request is not seen to be bargaining in good faith. Any subsequent retreat from that wholly unrealistic initial position is not viewed as a genuine concession, and thus is not reciprocated. The truly gifted negotiator, then, is one whose initial position is exaggerated enough to allow for a series of reciprocal concessions that will yield a desirable final offer from the opponent, yet is not so outlandish as to be seen as illegitimate from the start. It seems that certain of the most successful television producers, such as Grant Tinker and Gary Marshall, are masters of this art in their negotiations with network censors. In a candid interview with TV Guide, writer Dick Russell both admitted to deliberately inserting lines into scripts that a censor's sure to axe so that they could then retreat to the lines they really wanted included. Marshall appears especially active in this regard. Consider, for example, the following quotes from Russell's article. But Marshall not only admits his tricks, he seems to revel in them. On one episode of his then-top-rated Laverne and Shirley series, for example, he says, "We had a situation where Squiggy's in a rush to get out of his apartment and meet some girls upstairs. He says, 'Will you hurry up before I lose my lust?' But in the script, we put something even stronger, knowing the censors would cut it. They did, so we asked innocently, 'Well, how about we lose my lust?' 'That's good,' they said. Sometimes you gotta go at them backward." On the Happy Days series, the biggest censorship fight was over the word virgin. "That time," says Marshall, "I knew we'd have trouble, so we put the word in 7 times, hoping they'd cut 6 and keep 1. It worked. We used the same pattern again with the word pregnant." I witnessed another form of the rejection and retreat technique in my investigations of door-to-door sales operations. these organizations used a less engineered, more opportunistic version of the tactic. Of course, the most important goal for a door-to-door salesperson is to make the sale. However, the training programs of each of the companies I investigated emphasized that a second important goal was to obtain from prospects the names of referrals, friends, relatives, or neighbors on whom we could call. For a variety of reasons we will discuss in Chapter 5, the percentage of successful door-to-door sales increases impressively when the sales operator is able to mention the name of a familiar person who recommended the sales visit. Never as a sales trainee was I taught to get the sales pitch refused, so that I could then retreat to a request for referrals. In several such programs, though, I was trained to take advantage of the opportunity to secure referrals offered by a customer's purchase refusal. Well, if it is your feeling that a fine set of encyclopedias is not right for you at this time, perhaps you could help me by giving me the names of some others who might wish to take advantage of our company's great offer. What would be the names of some of these people you know? Many individuals who would not otherwise subject their friends to a high-pressure sales presentation do agree to supply referrals when the request is presented as a concession from a purchase request they have just refused. We have already discussed one reason for the success of the rejection and retreat technique. Its incorporation of the reciprocity rule. This larger than smaller request strategy is effective for a pair of other reasons as well. The first concerns the perceptual contrast principle we encountered in Chapter 1. That principle accounted for, among other things, the tendency of a man to spend more money on a sweater following his purchase of a suit than before. After being exposed to the price of the large item, the price of the less expensive one appears smaller by comparison. In the same way, the larger-than-smaller request procedure makes use of the contrast principle by making the smaller request look even smaller by comparison with the larger one. If I want you to lend me $5, I can make it seem like a smaller request by first asking you to lend me $10. One of the beauties of this tactic is that by first requesting $10 and then retreating to $5, I will have simultaneously engaged the force of the reciprocity rule and the contrast principle. Not only will my $5 request be viewed as a concession to be reciprocated, it will also look to you like a smaller request than if I had just asked for it straight away. In combination, the influences of reciprocity and perceptual contrast can present a fearsomely powerful force. Embodied in the rejection then retreat sequence, their conjoined energies are capable of genuinely astonishing effects. It is my feeling that they provide the only really plausible explanation of one of the most baffling political actions of our time, the decision to break into the Watergate offices of the Democratic National Committee that led to the ruin of Richard Nixon's presidency. One of the participants in that decision, Jeb Stuart Magruder, upon first hearing that the Watergate burglars had been caught, responded with appropriate bewilderment. How could we have been so stupid? Indeed, how? To understand how enormously ill-conceived an idea it was for the Nixon administration to undertake the break-in, it is necessary to review a few facts. The idea was that of G. Gordon Liddy, who was in charge of intelligence-gathering operations for the Committee to Re-elect the President, CRP. Liddy had gained a reputation among administration higher-ups as something of a flake, and there were questions about his stability and judgment. Liddy's proposal was extremely costly, requiring a budget of $250,000 in untraceable cash. In late March, when the proposal was approved in a meeting of the CRP director, John Mitchell, and his assistants Magruder and Frederick LaRue, the outlook for a Nixon victory in the November election could not have been brighter. Edmund Muskie, the only announced candidate the early polls had given a chance of unseating the president, had done poorly in the primaries. It looked very much as though the most defeatable candidate, George McGovern, would win his party's nomination. A Republican victory seemed assured. The break-in plan itself was a highly risky operation requiring the participation and discretion of 10 men. The Democratic National Committee and its chairman, Lawrence O'Brien, whose Watergate office was to be burglarized and bugged, had no information damaging enough to defeat the incumbent president. nor were they likely to get any unless the administration did something very, very foolish. Despite the obvious counsel of the above reasons, the expensive, chancy, pointless, and potentially calamitous proposal of a man whose judgment was known to be questionable was approved. How could it be that intelligent men of the attainment of Mitchell and Magruder would do something so very, very foolish? Perhaps the answer lies in a little-discussed fact. The $250,000 plan they approved was not Liddy's first proposal. In fact, it represented a significant concession on his part from two earlier proposals, of immense proportions. The first of these plans, made 2 months earlier in a meeting with Mitchell, Magruder, and John Dean, described a $1 million program that included, in addition to the bugging of the Watergate, a specially equipped communications chase plane, break-ins, kidnapping and mugging squads, and a yacht featuring high-class call girls to blackmail Democratic politicians. A second Liddy plan, presented a week later to the same group of Mitchell, Magruder, and Dean, eliminated some of the program and reduced the cost to $500,000. It was only after these initial proposals had been rejected by Mitchell that Liddy submitted his bare-bones $250,000 plan, in this instance to Mitchell, Magruder, and Frederick LaRue. This time the plan, still stupid, but less so than the previous ones, was approved. Could it be that I, a longtime patsy, and John Mitchell, a hardened and canny politician, might both have been so easily maneuvered into bad deals by the same compliance tactic? I by a Boy Scout selling candy, and he by a man selling political disaster? If we examine the testimony of Jeb Magruder, considered by most Watergate investigators to provide the most faithful account of the crucial meeting at which Liddy's plan was finally accepted, there are some instructive clues. First, Magruder reports that no one was particularly overwhelmed with the project. But after starting at the grandiose sum of $1 million, we thought that probably $250,000 would be an acceptable figure. We were reluctant to send him away with nothing. Mitchell, caught up in the feeling that we should leave Liddy a little something, signed off on it in the sense of saying, okay, let's give him $250,000 and let's see what he can come up with. In the context of Liddy's initial extreme requests, it seems that $250,000 had come to be a little something to be left as a return concession. With the clarity afforded by hindsight, Magruder had recalled Liddy's approach in as succinct an illustration of the rejection and retreat technique as I have ever heard. If he had come to us at the outset and said, "I have a plan to burglarize and wiretap Larry O'Brien's office," we might have rejected the idea out of hand. Instead, he came to us with his elaborate call girl, kidnapping, mugging, sabotage, wiretapping scheme. He had asked for the whole loaf when he was quite content to settle for half or even a quarter. It is also instructive that although he finally deferred to his boss's decision, only one member of the group, Frederick LaRue, expressed any direct opposition to the proposal, saying with obvious common sense, "I don't think it's worth the risk." He must have wondered why his colleagues Mitchell and Magruder did not share his perspective. Of course, there could be many differences between LaRue and the other two men that may have accounted for their differing opinions regarding the advisability of Liddy's plan. But one stands out. Of the three, only LaRue had not been present at the prior two meetings, where Liddy had outlined his much more ambitious programs. Perhaps then only LaRue was able to see the third proposal for the clunker that it was, and to react to it objectively, uninfluenced by the reciprocity and perceptual contrast forces acting upon the others. A bit earlier, we said that the rejection-then-retreat technique had, in addition to the reciprocity rule, a pair of other factors working in its favor. We have already discussed the first of those factors, the perceptual contrast principle. The additional advantage of the technique is not really a psychological principle, as in the case of the other two factors. It is more of a purely structural feature of the request sequence. Let's once again say that I wish to borrow $5 from you. By beginning with a $10 request, I really can't lose. If you agreed to it, I will have gotten twice the amount from you I would have settled for. If, on the other hand, you turn down my initial request, I can retreat to the $5 favor that I desired from the outset and, through the action of the reciprocity and contrast principles, greatly enhance my likelihood of success. Either way, I benefit. It's a case of heads I win, tails you lose. The clearest utilization of this aspect of the larger-than-smaller request sequence occurs in the retail store sales practice of talking the top of the line. Here, the prospect is invariably shown the deluxe model first. If the customer buys, there is frosting on the store's cake. However, if the customer declines, the salesperson effectively counteroffers with a more reasonably priced model. Some proof of the effectiveness of this procedure comes from a report in Sales Management Magazine, reprinted without comment in Consumer Reports. If you were a billiard table dealer, which would you advertise, the $329 model or the $3,000 model? The chances are you would promote the low-priced item and hope to trade the customer up when he comes to buy. But G. Warren Kelly, new business promotion manager at Brunswick, says you could be wrong. To prove his point, Kelly has actual sales figures from a representative store. During the first week, customers were shown the low end of the line and then encouraged to consider more expensive models, the traditional trading-up approach. The average table sale that week was $550. However, during the second week, customers were led instantly to a $3,000 table, regardless of what they wanted to see, and then allowed to shop the rest of the line, in declining order of price and quality. The result of selling down was an average sale of over $1,000. Given the remarkable effectiveness of the rejection-then-retreat technique, one might think that there could be a substantial disadvantage as well. The victims of the strategy might resent having been cornered into compliance. The resentment could show itself in a couple of ways. First, the victim might decide not to live up to the verbal agreement made with the requester. Second, the victim might come to distrust the manipulative requester, deciding never to deal with him again. If either or both of these events occurred with any frequency, a requester would want to give serious second thought to the use of the rejection-then-retreat procedure. Research indicates, however, that these victim reactions do not occur with increased frequency when the rejection-then-retreat technique is used. Somewhat astonishingly, it appears that they actually occur less frequently. Before trying to understand why this is the case, let's first look at the evidence. A study published in Canada throws light on the question of whether a victim of the rejection-then-retreat tactic will follow through with the agreement to perform the requester's second favor. In addition to recording whether target persons said yes or no to the desired request, to work for 2 unpaid hours one day in a community mental health agency, this experiment also recorded whether they showed up to perform their duties as promised. As usual, the procedure of starting with a larger request to volunteer for 2 hours of work per week in the agency for at least 2 years produced more verbal agreement to the smaller retreat request, 76%, than did the procedure of asking for the smaller request alone, 29%. The important result, though, concerned the show-up rate of those who volunteered, and again, the rejection-then-retreat procedure was the more effective one, 85% versus 50%. A different experiment examined whether the rejection-then-retreat sequence caused victims to feel so manipulated that they would refuse any further requests. In this study, the targets were college students who were each asked to give a pint of blood as part of the annual campus blood drive. One group of targets was first asked to give a pint of blood every 6 weeks for a minimum of 3 years. The other targets were asked only to give the single pint of blood. Those of both groups who agreed to give a pint of blood and who later appeared at the blood center were then asked if they would be willing to give their phone numbers so they could be called upon to donate again in the future. Nearly all the students who were about to give a pint of blood as a result of the rejection-then-retreat technique agreed to donate again later, 84%, while less than half of the other students who appeared at the blood center did so, 43%. Even for future favors, the rejection-then-retreat strategy proved superior. Strangely enough, then, it seems that the rejection-then-retreat tactic spurs people not only to agree to a desired request, but actually to carry out the request and finally to volunteer to perform further requests. What could there be about the technique that makes people who have been duped into compliance so bewilderingly likely to continue to comply? For an answer, we might look at the requester's act of concession, which is the heart of the procedure. We have already seen that as long as it is not viewed to be a transparent trick, the concession will likely stimulate a return concession. But what we have not yet examined is a little-known pair of positive byproducts of the act of concession: feelings of greater responsibility for and satisfaction with the arrangement. It is this set of sweet side effects that enables a technique to move its victims to fulfill their agreements and to engage in further such agreements. The desirable side effects of making a concession during an interaction with another person are nicely shown in studies of the way people bargain with each other. One experiment, conducted by social psychologists at UCLA, offers an especially apt demonstration. A subject in that study faced a negotiation opponent and was told to bargain with the opponent concerning how to divide between themselves a certain amount of money provided by the experimenters. The subject was also informed that if no mutual agreement could be reached after a certain period of bargaining, no one would get any money. Unknown to the subjects, the opponent was really an experimental assistant who had been previously instructed to bargain with the subject in one of three ways. With some of the subjects, the opponent made an extreme first demand, assigning virtually all of the money to himself, and stubbornly persisted in that demand throughout the negotiations. With another group of subjects, the opponent began with a demand that was moderately favorable to himself. He, too, steadfastly refused to move from that position during the negotiations. With a third group, the opponent began with the extreme demand and then gradually retreated to the more moderate one during the course of the bargaining. There were three important findings in this experiment that help us to understand why the rejection then retreat technique is so effective. First, compared to the two other approaches, the strategy of starting with an extreme demand and then retreating to the more moderate one produced the most money for the person using it. But this result is not very surprising in light of the previous evidence we have seen of the power of larger-than-smaller request tactics to bring about profitable agreements. It is the two additional findings of the study that are more striking. Responsibility. Those subjects facing the opponent who used the retreating strategy felt most responsible for the final deal. Much more than the subjects who faced a non-changing negotiation opponent, these subjects reported that they had successfully influenced the opponent to take less money for himself. Of course, we know that they hadn't done any such thing. The experimenter had instructed their opponent to retreat gradually from his initial demand, no matter what the subjects did. But it appeared to these subjects that they had made the opponent change, that they had produced his concessions. The result was that they felt more responsible for the final outcome of the negotiations. It does not require much of a leap from this finding to clarify the previous mystery of why the rejection-then-retreat technique causes its targets to live up to their agreements with such astounding frequency. The requester's concession within the technique not only causes targets to say yes more often, it also causes them to feel more responsible for having dictated the final agreement. Thus, the uncanny ability of the rejection-then-retreat technique to make its targets meet their commitments becomes understandable. A person who feels responsible for the terms of a contract will be more likely to live up to that contract. Satisfaction. Even though, on the average, they gave the most money to the opponent who used the concessions strategy, the subjects who were the targets of this strategy were the most satisfied with the final arrangement. It appears that an agreement that has been forged through the concessions of one's opponent is quite satisfying. With this in mind, we can begin to explain the second previously puzzling feature of the rejection-then-retreat tactic: the ability to prompt its victims to agree to further requests. Since the tactic uses a concession to bring about compliance, the victim is likely to feel more satisfied with the arrangement as a result. And it stands to reason that people who are satisfied with a given arrangement are more likely to be willing to agree to further such arrangements. How to say no. When up against a requester who employs the rule for reciprocation, you and I face a formidable foe. Whether by presenting us with an initial favor or initial concession, the requester will have enlisted a powerful ally in the campaign for our compliance. At first glance, our fortunes in such a situation would appear dismal. We could comply with the requester's wish and, in so doing, succumb to the reciprocity rule. Or we could refuse to comply and thereby suffer the brunt of the rule's force upon our deeply conditioned feelings of fairness and obligation. Surrender or suffer heavy casualties. Cheerless prospects indeed. Fortunately, these are not our only choices. With a proper understanding of the nature of our opponent, we can come away from the compliance battlefield unhurt and sometimes even better off than before. It is essential to recognize that the requester who invokes the reciprocation rule, or any other weapon of influence, to gain our compliance is not the real opponent. Such a requester has chosen to become a jiu-jitsu warrior who aligns himself with the sweeping power of reciprocation and then merely releases that power by providing a first favor or concession. The real opponent is the rule. If we are not to be abused by it, we must take steps to diffuse its energy. But how does one go about neutralizing the effect of a social rule like that for reciprocation? It seems too widespread to escape and too strong to overpower once it is activated. Perhaps the answer, then, is to prevent its activation. Perhaps we can avoid a confrontation with the rule by refusing to allow the requester to commission its force against us in the first place. Perhaps by rejecting the requester's initial favor or concession to us, we can evade the problem. Perhaps, but then perhaps not. Invariably declining the requester's initial offer of a favor or sacrifice works better in theory than in practice. The major problem is that when it is first presented, it is difficult to know whether such an offer is honest or whether it is the initial step in an exploitation attempt. If we always assume the worst, it would not be possible to receive the benefits of any legitimate favors or concessions offered by individuals who had no intention of exploiting the reciprocity rule. I have a colleague who remembers with anger how his 10-year-old daughter's feelings were terribly hurt by a man whose method of avoiding the jaws of the reciprocity rule was to refuse abruptly her kindness. The children of her class were hosting an open house at school for their grandparents, and her job was to give a flower to each visitor entering the school grounds. But the first man she approached with a flower growled at her, "Keep it." Not knowing what to do, she extended it toward him again, only to have him demand to know what he had to give in return. When she replied weakly, "Nothing, it's a gift," he fixed her with a disbelieving glare, insisted that he recognized her game, and brushed on past. The girl was so stung by the experience that she could not approach anyone else and had to be removed from her assignment, one she had anticipated fondly. It is hard to know whom to blame more here, the insensitive man or the exploiters who had abused his mechanical tendency to reciprocate a gift until his response had soured to a mechanical refusal. No matter whom you find more blameworthy, the lesson is clear. We will always encounter authentically generous individuals as well as many people who try to play fairly by the reciprocity rule rather than to exploit it. They will doubtless become insulted by someone who consistently rejects their efforts. Social friction and isolation could well result. A policy of blanket rejection, then, seems ill-advised. Another solution holds more promise. It advises us to accept the desirable first offers of others, but to accept those offers only for what they fundamentally are, not for what they are represented to be. If a person offers us a nice favor, let's say, we might well accept, recognizing that we have obligated ourselves to a return favor sometime in the future. To engage in this sort of arrangement with another is not to be exploited by that person through the rule of reciprocation. Quite the contrary. It is to participate fairly in the honored network of obligation that has served us so well, both individually and societally, from the dawn of humanity. However, if the initial favor turns out to be a device, a trick, an artifice designed specifically to stimulate our compliance with a larger return favor. That is a different story. Here, our partner is not a benefactor, but a profiteer. And it is here that we should respond to his action on precisely those terms. Once we have determined that his initial offer was not a favor, but a compliance tactic, we need only react to it accordingly to be free of its influence. As long as we perceive and define his action as a compliance device instead of a favor, he no longer has the reciprocation rule as an ally. The rule says that favors are to be met with favors. It does not require that tricks be met with favors. A practical example may make things more concrete. Let's suppose that a woman phoned one day and introduced herself as a member of the Home Fire Safety Association in your town. Suppose she then asked if you would be interested in learning about home fire safety, having your house checked for fire hazards, and receiving a home fire extinguisher all free of charge. Let's suppose further that you were interested in these things and made an evening appointment to have one of the association's inspectors come over to provide them. When he arrived, he gave you a small hand extinguisher and began examining the possible fire hazards of your home. Afterward, he gave you some interesting, though frightening, information about general fire dangers, along with an assessment of your home's vulnerability. Finally, he suggested that you get a home fire warning system, and left. Such a set of events is not implausible. Various cities and towns have nonprofit associations, usually made up of fire department personnel working on their own time, that provide free home fire safety inspections of this sort. Were these events to occur, you would clearly have been done a favor by the inspector. In accordance with the reciprocation rule, you should stand more ready to provide a return favor if you were to see him in need of aid at some point in the future. An exchange of favors of this kind would be in the best tradition of the reciprocity rule. A similar set of events with, however, a different ending would also be possible, in fact, more likely. Rather than leaving after recommending a fire alarm system, the inspector would launch into a sales presentation intended to persuade you to buy an expensive, heat-triggered alarm system manufactured by the company he represented. Door-to-door home fire alarm companies will frequently use this approach. Typically, their product, while effective enough, will be overpriced. Trusting that you will not be familiar with the retail costs of such a system and that if you decide to buy one, you will feel obligated to the company that provided you with a free extinguisher and home inspection. These companies will pressure you for an immediate sale. Using this free information and inspection gambit, fire protection sales organizations have flourished around the country. If you were to find yourself in such a situation with the realization that the primary motive of the inspector's visit was to sell you a costly alarm system, your most effective next action would be a simple private maneuver. It would involve the mental act of redefinition. Merely define whatever you have received from the inspector, extinguisher, safety information, hazard inspection, not as gifts, but as sales devices, and you will be free to decline or accept his purchase offer without even a tug from the reciprocity rule. A favor rightly follows a favor, not a piece of sales strategy. And if he subsequently responds to your refusal by proposing that you at least give him the names of some friends he might call on, use your mental maneuver on him again. Define his retreat to this smaller request as what, it is hoped after reading this chapter, you recognize it to be, a compliance tactic. Once done, there would be no pressure to offer the names as a return concession since his reduced request would not be viewed as a real concession. At this point, unhampered by an inappropriately triggered sense of obligation, you may once again be as compliant or non-compliant as you wish. Provided you are so inclined, you might even turn his own weapon of influence against him. Recall that the rule for reciprocation entitles a person who has acted in a certain way to a dose of the same thing. If you have determined that the fire inspector's gifts were used not as genuine gifts, but to make a profit from you, then you might want to use them to make a profit of your own. Simply take whatever the inspector is willing to provide, safety information, home extinguisher, thank him politely, and show him out the door. After all, the reciprocity rule asserts that if justice is to be done, exploitation attempts should be exploited. Reader's Report from a former TV and stereo salesperson. For quite a while, I worked for a major retailer in their television and stereo department. Salespeople in this department are paid on a commission basis. However, continued employment was, and still is, based on the ability to sell service contracts rather than merchandise. Company policy was that for every 10 sales you made, you had to sell at least 4 service contracts. Failure to bring your service contract sales up to expected levels for 2 consecutive months resulted in threats, relocation, or termination. Once I recognized the importance of meeting my sales contract quota, I devised a plan that used the rejection-then-retreat technique, although I didn't know its name at the time. A customer had the opportunity to buy from 1 to 3 years' worth of service contract coverage at the time of the sale. Most of the sales staff attempted just to sell a single-year policy. That was my intention as well, since a 1-year contract counted just as much toward my quota as a 3-year contract did. Initially, however, when making my sales pitch, I would advocate the longest and most expensive plan, realizing that most people would not be willing to spend that much, about $140. But this gave me an excellent opportunity later, after being rejected in my sincere attempt to sell the 3-year plan, to retreat to the 1-year extension, and its relatively small $34.95 price, which I was thrilled to get. This proved highly effective, as I sold sales contracts to an average of 70% of my customers, who seemed very satisfied with the purchase, while others in my department clustered around 40%. I never told anyone how I did it until now. Notice how, as is usually the case, use of the rejection-then-retreat tactic engages the action of the contrast principle as well. Not only did the $140 initial request make the $34.95 request seem like retreat, it made that second request seem smaller too. Chapter 3. Commitment and Consistency. Hobgoblins of the Mind. It is easier to resist at the beginning than at the end. Leonardo da Vinci. A study done by a pair of Canadian psychologists uncovered something fascinating about people at the racetrack. Just after placing a bet, they are much more confident of their horse's chances of winning than they are immediately before laying down that bet. Of course, nothing about the horse's chances actually shifts. It's the same horse on the same track in the same field, but in the minds of those bettors, its prospects improve significantly once that ticket is purchased. Although a bit puzzling at first glance, the reason for the dramatic change has to do with the common weapon of social influence. Like the other weapons of influence, this one lies deep within us, directing our actions with quiet power. It is quite simply our nearly obsessive desire to be and to appear consistent with what we have already done. Once we have made a choice or taken a stand, we will encounter personal and interpersonal pressures to behave consistently with that commitment. Those pressures will cause us to respond in ways that justify our earlier decision. Take the bettors in the racetrack experiment. 30 seconds before putting down their money, they had been tentative and uncertain. 30 seconds after the deed, they were significantly more optimistic and self-assured. The act of making a final decision, in this case of buying a ticket, had been the critical factor. Once a stand had been taken, the need for consistency pressured these people to bring what they felt and believed into line with what they had already done. They simply convinced themselves that they had made the right choice and, no doubt, felt better about it all. Before we see such self-delusion as unique to racetrack habitués, we should examine the story of my neighbor Sarah and her live-in boyfriend Tim. They met at a hospital where he worked as an x-ray technician and she as a nutritionist. They dated for a while, even after Tim lost his job, and eventually they moved in together. Things were never perfect for Sarah. She wanted Tim to marry her and to stop his heavy drinking. Tim resisted both ideas. After an especially difficult period of conflict, Sarah broke off the relationship and Tim moved out. At the same time, an old boyfriend of Sarah's returned to town after years away and called her. They started seeing each other, socially, and quickly became serious enough to plan a wedding. They had gone so far as to set a date and issue invitations when Tim called. He had repented and wanted to move back in. When Sarah told him her marriage plans, he begged her to change her mind. He wanted to be together with her as before, but Sarah refused, saying she didn't want to live like that again. Tim even offered to marry her, but she still said she preferred the other boyfriend. Finally, Tim volunteered to quit drinking if she would only relent. Feeling that under those conditions Tim had the edge, Sarah decided to break her engagement, cancel the wedding, retract the invitations, and let Tim move back in with her. Within a month, Tim informed Sarah that he didn't think he needed to stop his drinking after all. A month later, he had decided that they should wait and see before getting married. 2 years have since passed. Tim and Sarah continue to live together exactly as before. He still drinks. There are still no marriage plans. Yet Sarah is more devoted to Tim than she ever was. She says that being forced to choose taught her that Tim really is number one in her heart. So, after choosing Tim over her other boyfriend, Sarah became happier with him, even though the conditions under which she had made her choice have never been fulfilled. Obviously, horse race bettors are not alone in their willingness to believe in the correctness of a difficult choice once made. Indeed, we all fool ourselves from time to time in order to keep our thoughts and beliefs consistent with what we have already done or decided. Psychologists have long understood the power of the consistency principle to direct human action. Prominent theorists such as Leon Festinger, Fritz Haider, and Theodore Newcomb have viewed the desire for consistency as a central motivator of our behavior. But is this tendency to be consistent really strong enough to compel us to do what we ordinarily would not want to do? There is no question about it. The drive to be and look consistent constitutes a highly potent weapon of social influence, often causing us to act in ways that are clearly contrary to our own best interests. Take as proof what happened when psychologist Thomas Moriarty staged thefts on a New York City beach to see if onlookers would risk personal harm to halt the crime. In the study, a research accomplice would put a beach blanket down 5 feet from the blanket of a randomly chosen individual, the experimental subject. After a couple of minutes on the blanket spent relaxing and listening to music from a portable radio, the accomplice would stand up and